Welcome to Share Talk, the only podcast where investors come first.
Hello and welcome to Share Talk. Today I'm joined by Mike Ingram, who's an independent market strategist. How are you today, Mike?
I'm good, Zach. I'm very, very good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We've spoken in the past and it's taken me this long to drum up the courage to speak to you again. But we're at an interesting time in the markets. Probably two highlights that have, or low lights in some cases, stand out at the moment. One is Neil Woodford, which is possibly not a great development, and the other one is Bitcoin over 51,000 or over 50,000. But maybe we'll start with Mr. Woodford first. Any particular view on this development that we've had?
Well, the guy's got a bit of a brass neck, isn't he? He loses investors, an absolute packet full of money, and now he's coming back to possibly have another swing at it. I mean, in this incarnation, given that it's going to be a Jersey-based fund, he's only going to be talking to professional investors as opposed to retail. Then you could say, well, he's probably not going to be in a position where he's going to do that much damage, and even if he does, well, he's dealing with some large funds perhaps who can shoulder any pain. But you kind of wonder why he's doing this. Certainly he seems to want to replicate the strategy which failed very, very badly last time around. He wants to focus on biotech, pharma. He's going to be looking at some very possibly illiquid companies, startups. It all looks like high octane, high risk stuff. He says he doesn't want to be spend the rest of his life hiding. I kind of understand that, but it doesn't look like something I certainly would be rushing out to buy. And the other thing is, of course, is the investigation into Woodford's former investment funds is still ongoing by the FCA. I mean, they've been going at it since June 2019. A lot of people very keen to see what they have to say about that, whether Woodford himself is significantly culpable. I think there's plenty of, should we say, prima facie evidence that might be the case. And, of course, the FCA itself was generally felt to have been asleep at the wheel on this, and that perhaps might also explain why this investigation has taken such a long time. So it's stirred the pot again, and we don't quite know what's cooking right now.
Well, to put the I'm not quite on Mr. Woodford's Christmas card list yet, but there are one or two maybe mitigating points. The first one, taking it in reverse order, the first one is if you're waiting for the FCA to come up with a report, you probably die of old age, so that would be another 10 years for them to come up with any conclusion. Point number one, and life is too short. Point number two, as you mentioned, there were a lot of retail investors in the mix in his original incarnation. And the reason for the disaster was that a lot of them wanted to get out at the bottom in a sort of a dip in the market. And it was really a liquidity situation rather than anything wrong with his strategy. In fact, his strategy looks now to have been quite golden. His biotech bias, his startup bias, we've seen obviously US tech stocks and the whole that whole area go sort of mental. So he was basically betting on the right thing, and obviously with COVID as well, that's become even better because a lot of the companies and situations he was backing would have benefited from the pandemic. So maybe he's coming back just to sort of say that actually I was basically right, but I was undermined by probably the wrong type of investors, and maybe the investors he's choosing now, the high net worths and the institutions, won't be so jittery.
Well, possibly. I mean, you can blame the investors, you can blame the timing of the market, but if you want to use that as an excuse, then I think we're all geniuses, then, aren't we? I mean, one thing is for sure is that people ended up investing in things in Woodford's previous funds that they they didn't think they were going to be investing in. The strategy definitely shifted, and I think part of the problem was that there wasn't sufficient notification, and there was this so-called mission creep, I think they called it in Vietnam, where you just send in a few advisors, and before you know it, you're fighting a full-on war. And that's what's kind of happened. The Woodford Fund, previous Woodford Fund, kind of morphed into something rather different from what investors had initially been told they were going to be investing in. And yes, of course, liquidity was a big part of it. And it's interesting because Woodford recently gave an interview, I think it was to the Telegraph, in preparation for this new fund launch. And whilst he said, look, he accepts responsibility for last fund going bust, essentially, he then turned on the fund's administrators, Link Fund Solutions, and said, well, they should never have gated the fund in the first place, they never have stopped people withdrawing withdrawing funds from it. But, at the end of the day, if you've got a whole bunch of relatively illiquid positions in your fund, then all you're doing is, if you keep the fund open, all you're doing is inviting liquidation of the most liquid assets. And then the people who are left with the stuff which, by definition, is illiquid. So, you're favouring the people to actually go out first. It's like a bank run. You're almost saying, please withdraw our deposit. We have enough cash left. So it was kind of, I think it's kind of impractical to really point the finger at the fund administrator. And, again, this is part of the SA report. You say the report may not come out. Well, I think the FCA, all other things being equal, would be happier if the fund came out when nobody was talking about Neil Woodford, which is not now, clearly, because we're both talking about Neil Woodford. Going back to your other point, I think the reason this is happening now is probably testament to where the market is right now, which is extremely frothy. And, companies having no profits, they're not being a company, you've got these SPAFs floating around, you've got the meme, boom investments, they got the Reddit corralling investors and short squeezing and going on. These are very, very weird times in markets. And he's probably taking a step back and thinking, hell yeah, I can give this a go. I can make this work. And presumably he would not be going out publicly saying he's going to launch unless he's got some assurance of some institutional backing. I remember last time around he raised, I think, £1.7 billion in just a few days. Now I presume it's perhaps not going to be quite as easy for him this time around, but he clearly thinks he's going to be able to raise enough to give it a go.
Well, speaking of exceptional times, we've got Bitcoin through 50,000. I think it's only been in the last, probably since the turn of the year, that the mainstream media finally stopped saying that it's a scam or it's a money laundering source or it's a this or it's a that or it's all going to end in tears, and embracing the market fully, the crypto space. Is it another case of what could possibly go wrong?
Well, the fact that the mainstream media is finally embracing it, I think, is probably a bit worrisome, isn't it?
Yeah, but they went on for, I think, let's say the dawn of it was 2012, 2013. Yeah. I mean, it was basically, worse than, the coronavirus in terms of the financial markets. It was hated. It was, dodgy people involved. It's almost like, if you're doing it, you're a money launderer or a tax evader or just a general, I mean, there's nothing. I can't think of anything polite, a polite way of saying it. So, just the worst of the worst. And now it's like, why weren't people in it at 5,000 or 2,000, or why weren't they in it all along? It was such a good idea.
Captain Hindsight again, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, my own experience. I've got to admit, I've tended not to plunge in too deeply into the whole discussion around cryptos, because I think that way leads to madness, quite frankly. And the thing is, there's no real middle ground on this, as far as I can work out. People either think this is worth, effectively infinite amounts of money. It is almost literally like printing money, or it's a complete scam and it's completely worthless. And there's very few people in between. I mean, I actually had a crack a few years ago at trying to, you know, value Bitcoin on the basis that it was going to hold, you know, such and such a percentage of the world money supply by, you know, 2030 or whatever it was. And I think it was $169,000 per coin at the time. But, you know, I gave up in the end because I felt like I was just plucking figures out of the air, even though that was precisely what I wasn't trying to do. I was trying to say, well, these are my assumptions, and if I work it back, then, you know, that's the number. I mean, for me, if you look at where policymakers are at the moment, you know, central banks in the main, but also other regulators, the whole thrust over the, you know, and this has accelerated over the last year or so, is to, you know, to try to come up with more tools to manipulate the money supply. And I think the challenge that cryptos pose for those authorities at the moment is completely polarized. If you say that we're going to turn money supply over to cryptocurrencies, not just Bitcoin, because of course there's no barrier to entry to creating new cryptos. So yes, I take it that the amount of Bitcoin is going to be capped, but you can create, you know, Bitcoin 2, Bitcoin 3, Bitcoin 4. There's no limit to it. So you can either basically get rid of your control of the money supply completely, basically outsource it to a third party or third parties, or you could have your own crypto, and you can have your own digital, you know, base money currencies, and you could even then have negative interest rates on cash, which you don't technically have at the moment. So you either have no control of the money supply, or even more control of the money supply. Now, if you're a central bank, which are you going to do? Yeah, turkeys never vote for Christmas. So my issue is, it's not about whether there's intrinsic value in Bitcoin or whatever, but this whole argument of intrinsic value ends up being like a philosophy discussion anyway. Because you say, well, what's the intrinsic value of gold? And you go, well, it's worth $2,000 an ounce or whatever. And you just go, yeah, but what's the? You're describing in terms of something else, which you say has no intrinsic value. So it becomes a circular discussion. But the point is like, if the authorities say that something has got no value, then they can make it very, very difficult to crystallize that value. You know, when you see, as you did a few days ago, that MasterCard would say that, well, they will take Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, or in fact, what they're going to do is they're going to accept payments by a third party in Bitcoin, and then they'll convert that into, you know, presumably dollars. Then that gives it credibility. But central banks turned around and said, look, we think this is dangerous. We think this is destabilizing the financial system of the markets in such a way that, it's dangerous, and we want to put a cap on it, then, you know, all of a sudden this thing is going to deflate. And it's ironic, of course, because the whole reason this is happening is because of central banks' own policies. I mean, all of this is a sign of all this liquidity sloshing around, looking for a home, and the fact that you got zero or even negative rates on cash, and, you know, gaining leverage, gaining margin through trading accounts. It has never been easier. You know, this is all symptomatic of what the central banks are doing. But yeah, of course, I mean, they'll never blame themselves. They'll just. It's easy to blame a bunch of people on Reddit and say, well, they're just crazy. We need to legislate. So, I mean, all of it is, I suppose, a rather long-winded way of saying, I don't even think the intrinsic value argument is worth having. The end game is, do the authorities want to see this succeed, or do they not? And if they don't, then all cryptos potentially are in trouble. And I think central banks have got very good reasons for not wanting this to succeed. I think if it should succeed, they wanted to succeed on their terms with their own cryptos. They don't want this to be a significant part of the monetary base, which they don't control. And, you know, you can agree with that or disagree with it. I mean, at the moment, I think you can't actually argue it either way, because we don't know what the facts are. But if you take a view of what the end game might look back and work your way back, you can say, well, this is probably not something that the various central banks want to succeed. And you probably remember that, having been initially very relaxed about this, Bank of England, as soon as Bitcoin started doing really well last time, so 2017, then they started talking about regulation, and then it all didn't know when Bitcoin, you know, collapsed effectively, they weren't talking about it again, and now all the central banks are taking another look.
So isn't the logical conclusion is that we're going to have there's a risk that the authorities will just close the whole crypto thing down, will just say, look, this is a tumor, has to be removed, the financial system can't take it because of COVID or this or that, whatever reason. You can't have, you know, let's say Bitcoin gets to $1 million but before the end of the year, which it actually could. You can't have that. You can't have the tail wagging the financial system dog, which it is a dog, and therefore they'll have to be, you know, it'll have to end, and it'll end badly.
I think you're precisely correct. I mean,
it'll be like the tulip bubble bursting, or whatever other bubbles we've had. It'll be something like that. Whatever manias we've had, it's going to be one of those, because there's no way the financial system, not in any conspiratorial way, but you can't have two currencies or two currencies running in parallel. It just doesn't work. You can't have that. It's a two-headed monster. You can't have that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I mean, when I did my analysis, and I probably should put some air quotes around that, a few years ago in the valuation of Bitcoin, I mean, it was all predicated on the fact of, you know, what are the practical functions of currency. You know, it's a store of value, it's a medium of exchange, etc. And you go, well, hang on, what percentage of the global market is Bitcoin going to capture by 2030? And, you know, how much money would that have to be in, you know, dollars, and then, you know, discount it back? So that's how I came up with that number. But then you just go, well, hang on, is actually Bitcoin functioning as this sort of store of value? Well, in a sense it is, but in a sense it isn't. It's just too damn volatile to be a store of value. I mean, enormous volatility. That's why one of the reasons that traders love it. Because, you know, it is very, very choppy, and to a large extent, whereas, you know, there's no doubt the central bank policies have helped to inflate, should we say, traditional asset prices, and it's done it in a relatively non-volatile way. I mean, volatility suppression is one of the things, again, that central banks are supposed to do. You know, it's just the so-called, you know, Greenspan put, Bernanke put, Yellen put, Powell put. You know, it's essentially a one-way street to a large extent. But no, I mean, I just don't think that we're in a situation where, as you say, well, they're just going to allow this to keep running and running and running. It's not about intrinsic value. It's about about the legality of the whole thing. And, you know, the authorities can make life very, very difficult for, you know, crypto operators, people who operate crypto exchanges. I mean, these are relatively highly regulated entities, more so over the last 10 years, and pulling that authorization away from them would drive it just underground. The Bitcoin and its various clones aren't behaving like currencies. They're behaving like investments. And you go, okay, well, it's an investment then. And you go, yeah, but then that's a different argument. You're not arguing that this is going to be, you know, a reserve currency in the years to come. You're just saying, oh, it's an investment. And then let's have a different discussion about what it is and isn't then. Because if it's not a currency and it's an investment, let's discuss it as an investment. And of course, once you start to go down that road, you perhaps have a very different conversation. Because traditionally, investments, you say, well, does it generate any cash flow? Well, no, cash doesn't generate any cash flow. Well, does it appreciate? Well, you just go, well, yes, it does appreciate, but usually things appreciate or depreciate on the basis of the cash flow that it can generate. And they just go, well, we've just established it doesn't generate any cash flow. So, you know, you're just chasing your tail with that particular discussion.
So cryptocurrencies are basically blue sky tech stocks.
Well, you know, it's I don't want to generalize on this because, you know, potentially these are real businesses. These are real businesses. I mean, you know, I suppose the ultimate is some of these special purpose acquisition, you know, funds and SPACs, which have, you know, come to the fore and been talked a lot in the press. I mean, these are basically options on purchasing companies. And, you know, in those cases, you have to look at the, you know, the sponsors and saying, well, you know, have they got a track record? What are they bringing to the table? How much do we know about the companies they're looking at? I mean, some of these are effectively blank check. I mean, they've been described as blank check companies. It varies enormously. Some of them we've they're just shells, and we don't know, have any idea what they're going to buy with the money they're raising. Some of them, you know, there's a reasonable level of disclosure. I mean, it's not terribly highly regulated. It's something that's more popular, certainly in the US and to some extent the UK, than continental Europe, and that probably speaks to sort of the risk appetite at this sort of very high level of the, you know, equity market. So I wouldn't be against it completely, but again, you have to do your homework. I mean, just because it's in a certain sector or it's in a certain wrapper doesn't necessarily make it a good or a bad thing. But what I think the problem is that, you know, you have certain terms, and, you know, we're going back to sort of the Reddit crowd, sort of meme stocks, and you just go, well, we've got this sort of, you know, label, and we'll put it around social media, and you know, it will generate a buying frenzy, or a frenzy of shorting, or, you know, a frenzy of trading activity in one direction generally. And, you know, then just by sheer weight of numbers, we won't be right because we're fundamentally right. We'll be right because of through effectively brute force. And, you know, you could say, well, that's a cop out, Mike. You know, because, well, because if it wasn't worth it, it wouldn't, you know, these wouldn't be at these prices. And you go, oh no. You'd have to look back that far to say that the market isn't always right. So just because you've bullied the stock into a certain price doesn't mean that it's right. Now, of course, again, as I say, that's a cop out, because I would say, oh, you know, I thought it was worth, you know, 10 grand. It went to 20, then it went to 5. And then you go, well, yeah, it was on 10 on the way down. And I was right. But the thing is, when you start to talk about, again, things intrinsic value and things like that, the actual calculation fundamentally is extremely difficult. It's difficult even the best of times. But when you're discounting by rates which are really close to zero, again, courtesy of central banks, then the range of values you can come up with are absolutely enormous. And they're also enormous, generally speaking, to the upside. And that's, again, where the financial instability argument comes in. You don't have to be, you know, a retail investor with no investment knowledge, or a retail investor with malign intent, or even a professional investor with malign intent. You know, people can go through the numbers and crunch out very, very different numbers because of what their inputs are. Yeah. So, but you know, we're coming back full circle, in as much as, you know, this is one of the reasons that this low interest rate environment causes such market instability, because you've got an enormous range of valuations which you can plausibly come up with for most stocks, not necessarily Bitcoin because you're not, there's nothing to discount as such, but anything which, you know, hopefully has cash flow at some point in time, then yeah, that's the situation you're in, I'm afraid.
So the cure is worse than the disease with the whole QE experiment, etc.
Well, it was always mad, yeah? Because, I mean, if you think about where it all started, well, for a start, we are definitely not where we were supposed to be. Okay, even before the pandemic hoved into view, you had central banks basically reversing any idea that they were going to raise interest rates. The Fed had restarted QE. You had the, you know, and also the... also eventually, you know, slashed interest rates. You've had ECB doing the same thing. You've had Bank of England, you know, toying with the idea of negative interest rates, although they haven't pulled the trigger on that yet. But if you go back to where, you know, if you go back to where we started, it was all supposed to be, oh, we'll have a few years of you know, low rates, not negative rates at the time, and, you know, the economists will get back on their feet, and then we'll all sing kumbaya and we'll all be happy. That did not happen. And central bankers, even more so than everybody else, will not admit, generally speaking, they've made any mistakes. And all say, oh, this is, you know, this is what we forecast. And you go, well, no, it wasn't. It's what your forecast became, but it wasn't what your forecast was initially. So this old idea, you just slash rates for a few years and just reinflate the economy, you know, in 2009, 10, 11, whatever, that didn't happen. And it was particularly moronic, quite frankly, that they did it at a time when they were asking banks to effectively deleverage, because it wasn't about what's the interest rates. I mean, banks will just want to price that up on a spread anyway. Yeah, and we're seeing the negative effects of negative or zero interest rates in the Eurozone, because it's further eroding already poor bank profitability. But, you know, it's like pushing on a piece of string. You're saying to banks, well, we want you to lend more money, but we're going to make it less profitable for you to do it. Oh, and by the way, we want you to build capital at the same time. So he was just like, well, okay, great. You won't be surprised that we're not going to lend very much. And at the same time, a lot of countries, including eventually the UK, were pursuing austerity programs. So, you know, I mean, I hope this isn't complete hindsight because I was writing about it at the time. It was just crazy to be almost entirely reliant on monetary policy to reflate economies at a point in time when monetary policy was likely to be particularly ineffective. And all of this wasn't necessarily because of the market, it was because of the aftermath of the market, I suppose, but all of this was due to design. So, you know, it's like giving Greece loads of money and going, oh, what could possibly go wrong? Well, we know what could go wrong. It's gone wrong before. Oh, and by the way, it's happened again. So we are where we are now. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what's the get out from this is. I mean, I think before the pandemic came into, you know, started, people were coming down to the idea, even in Europe, that perhaps government spending a little bit of money might be a good idea. But the thing is, it would have been a good idea 10 years ago. And I don't know whether that opportunity now exists. We've kind of done things the way that Japan have gone about it. Yeah, where we had, you know, negative interest rates, zero interest rates, quantitative easing, 25 years ago. And then they kind of, you know, expected that alone to reflect the economy. It didn't reflect the economy. And now, you know, they've been running very, very big deficits and the government deficits going up and blah, 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 blah. I understand that. The problem is they're waiting for something to happen, which isn't going to happen, which is inflation. Because the real economy, this liquidity isn't going to the real economy. It's going to things like Bitcoin. You know, they're not seeing inflation in the real economy. The inflation is going into asset prices. And that's the thing. The evidence of that their policy has been effective is all around us. It just hasn't been effective the way they thought it was going to be effective, because it never was going to be effective in that way. You know, and my worry is, of course, is that, you know, the options available now are very limited. I mean, the central banks seem to be doubling down. They seem to be saying, well, you know, it didn't work last time, so, you know, let's try the more of it. And in a sense that, you know, people, you know, fiscal authorities, governments essentially, have been really forced to some extent to splurge their few remaining bullets on propping up the economy during COVID. So it does rather feel like we're kind of boxed in on policy, and any exit is going to be a very painful one. You know, I mean, ultimately, recoveries aren't led by consumption, they're led by investment, because, and it's a bit of a misleading, because they'll say, well, you know, UK economy is 70% consumption, but yeah, but that consumption is predicated on wages, and most wages are paid by businesses, and for businesses, that's considered an investment, you know, which is probably their single biggest investment, are the wages of its employees. And, you know, my understanding, you've got something like 500,000 businesses, say, in the UK, which collectively employ 9 million people, which are, you know, in poor shape, shall we say, which may well be facing a bit of a crisis, particularly when the furlough scheme is due to roll off, I think, in April. So this whole idea that, you know, we're just going to, you know, spend our way, households have been piling up cash, and we're just going to spend our way out of what has been a very, very deep recession, I think is questionable. There's no doubt that, you know, a number of households, perhaps very many households, have just been, you know, they work from home, they're still in employment, they are piling up cash. You know, hell, we might go for another skiing holiday in probably in Italy this year. But for a lot of people are in a very, very tough situation. And I don't think collectively they're going to make up for the people who have come out of it pretty well. I mean, these are generally households who would have pretty much spent every last penny they've got, and that would have been circulating in the economy. You know, if you've been banking furlough checks and you find at the end of that you've actually been unemployed, I mean, are you going to splurge them? I would imagine you might have a round at the local pub, and then and then next day just go, oh God, what a hangover. What do I do now? So yeah, one shot wonder. So yeah, it does feel a little bit dystopian, Zach, I have to admit. You know, and markets, I'm afraid, are probably adding to the surreal feel to it all.
Well, Mike, on that note, thank you for mentioning the magic word, which is pub. We look forward to reconvening there at a time which is as safe as possible. But in the meantime, Mike Ingram, independent market strategist, thank you very much for speaking to Share Talk.
You're welcome, Zach. All the best.
Thank you for listening. Remember to visit our website for more news and other podcasts at www.share-talk.com.